Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're happy to be joined by expert job recruiter Stuart Taylor, talking about the do's and don'ts of job interviews. We often spend so much time on a resume that we forget how important it is to prepare for the actual interview process. Social media expert Patrick Charles talks about the effects social media has had on the music industry, and our lifestyle maven Christine Eisner is back talking about fall streamlining your home. We then wrap things up with a killer remix from Lady Gaga, Applause.
Capture your need for sound.
Finding a job is never an easy thing to do. With so much time spent on creating and perfecting your resume, are we forgetting to concentrate on the most important aspect of all, the actual interview? Stuart Taylor, a recruiting expert, joins us today to talk about some of the biggest mistakes people can make throughout the process of looking for a job. Stuart, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, Kelly, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
What should people be doing to prepare for a job interview? Because I know that's a very scary thought.
It can be a little nerve-wracking. That is very true. The first part is to do exactly what you said. Prepare for the job interview.
Okay.
it's not a good idea to show up cold. I have an analogy that I use that will help people just as far as preparation. If they think of interviewing in terms of dating, in terms of you're showing up for a date, you want to make a good impression, your long-term goal is not just a relationship, but ideally a marriage or commitment to that person. The dynamic between you and the person you're dating is virtually identical to that between the job seeker and the interviewer. And if you can understand those two parallels and comparisons, it'll help you understand what you're certain thing that you should and shouldn't do. If you were to plan a great date, you would do exactly that. You would plan and find out what does this person want, what do they like, what are their interests, and I will try to create a date that meets those needs. Because you can spend a whole lot of time planning a date without having any idea what the person wants and fall flat on your face. It can actually be embarrassing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Take someone boating and they hate the water or something like that. So with an interview, it's the same thing. You want to find out as much as you can, depending on time, you know, about the company, about the job, as much as you can about the employer, about the clients, customers, about the products or services that they're offering. So you can start from there to formulate, okay, this is what they want. Now let me take a look and see what I have to offer. And I can walk you through a couple of steps that you can do to make that very feasible.
Yeah, go right on ahead.
Sure. One of the best things, if someone had 10 minutes before an interview, one of the best things they can do is do a quick self-assessment of what am I bringing to the table? What are my top 5 and top 10 strengths that I'm bringing to the table as they pertain to this job? So if I'm a bodybuilder, for example, literally a strength, and I'm applying for a sales position, it's kind of irrelevant unless I'm going to tie in commitment. You know, one of my strengths might be focus or commitment. So I might use that and use bodybuilding as a supportive example. But what you want to do is have at least a top 5 and top 10 list of your greatest strengths. And then specifically, you should have examples for each one. Because if I'm an interviewer and I'm asking you, why should I hire you? Why will you make the best employee? What I'm looking for is I'm looking for your strengths. How do your strengths line up with this position? The person I believe is the person that's able to provide me specific supportive examples. And if you haven't thought that through before your interview, the more than likely chance that at least on some of those, you're going to fail to recall what your best supportive example is, and it sounds like you're making stuff up.
Is it ever okay, Stuart, to be a little nervous when you're in there? Like, because I know, you know, when you watch movies and stuff, it always looks like the person that's the most calm and collected, you know, gets the job or whatever. But I'm assuming maybe it's okay if they see you be a little bit nervous.
You know, it's interesting. A couple things. Anxiety that is visible, in my opinion, is never good. Think about when you go to a presentation and there's a speaker. You don't know the speaker. First time you see the speaker is when they're up there. if they act nervous, you wonder what's wrong with them.
Right.
That's their thought. It's like, why don't they know what they're talking? Why are they nervous? And you start to formulate these questions of, maybe they're not credible. Maybe they've never done this before. And it's the same thing on an interview. It's okay. I mean, it's okay to have some internal anxieties. I had to go on an interview several years ago, and I had some anxiety, and I do an interview coach. So, but as far as showing that, that's a different story. You know, stay calm, cool, and collected. Now, one of the things that can help you alleviate interview anxiety is what we just talked about. Interview anxiety, in my opinion, comes from basically one thing. What if I can't answer the questions that they ask? Because otherwise, it's just a conversation. You know, you have a conversation with your friends, you don't have any anxiety. You have a conversation with your family, you can talk about work, no anxiety. You have a conversation with an employer, and you're like, oh my God.
Right. So
that's really, what's the difference? Well, I'm afraid if I can't answer one of their questions, they may not move me forward. And that's really the root of the anxiety. So how do you get rid of that? Well, if you understand that the majority of an interviewer's questions are, who are you? Meaning, what are your strengths? Prove it to me, which are those supportive examples we talked about, and then show me how these strengths apply at this job. If you take the time to write out your top strengths, and especially if you do 10, and you write three examples for each strength, you now have 30 supportive examples, 30 things that you can talk to, talking points. And I can pretty much guarantee you, in any interview, which lasts, 15 minutes to an hour and a half, you'll never even get to all those talking points. You'll have more answers than the interviewer requires. And you won't need to be nervous because you'll have the answers.
Should you ever go in with notes, Stuart? Like, I don't mean like, you know, a binder full, but it's like, do you ever go in? Like, do you go in carrying something, I guess is my question? Because sometimes, like, I know even if I go to a meeting at work, I actually like to take notes at a meeting or whatever. So I don't always do it, but I always feel like if I go in looking like I'm prepared to take in what they're telling me, I look a bit more serious.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple of things. One is, I'm just going to touch on this, is perception is everything. So if you walk in, let's just say you walk in without anything, the perception is you're not prepared. That's the perception. So that's a bad, you don't want to give that up. The reality of it is, it is a very good idea to, A, take notes on an interview. And some people are a little uncomfortable about that, thinking, oh, is that awkward or is that offensive? If you ever need an icebreaker to get through that, just say, do you mind if I take a few notes? Every interviewer is going to say that's fine. So notes express interest. If you talk to someone for an hour and you take no notes, I'll tell you how I feel when I'm interviewing someone. If they take no notes over the course of a 1 hour period, I don't really think they're taking me seriously because it's like there's no way you're going to remember everything I said
right.
to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells me that there's interest. Coming in with notes, meaning if you come in with a list of questions, and we shouldn't have like an arsenal of questions that's 100 miles long, but you should have questions because those also express interest. And coming in with notes of certain things that you may want to talk to is fine. Now, as long as you're not sitting there, you know, imagine someone up talking to a teleprompter screen and it just looks like they're reading everything. Well, that's bad. But you can have the screen there and glance at it to make sure you're covering points. That's fine. As long as, you know, your primary contact, eye contact, is with the interviewer.
When it comes to what you wear, Stuart, I mean, this has been talked about since the beginning of time, it feels. What's your position on how you dress for an interview?
Okay, there's appropriate attire and there's inappropriate attire, and I go back to the dating analogy. You wouldn't want to show up to a black tie event and your date shows up in shorts or a t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't want to show up to a presidential ball and, you know, someone's got hoop earrings the size, you know, they go down to their waist. It would just be, that's inappropriate. Well, on an interview, there are several things that happen that make first impressions. One is your appearance. And if you are not dressed appropriately, and I would generally tell people to err on the side of more professional than less professional. If you're not sure, dress it up a little bit. Don't go with the bow tie and the tux, but go with the suit, the business suit, men or women, you know, the good shoes. Don't play it down. This is not it's not a night out with your friends. It's an interview where you have to make a positive impression. And that impression, if it's the wrong impression, literally, it doesn't matter what you talk about after that. The interviewer may nod, they may be friendly, they may be nice, but they've already disqualified you. So suit and tie, wherever possible, it's a very good idea to find out what does the corporate culture dictate. And you could either visit or go online and get an idea, but I would still dress it up a notch. They are observing you. So even if you go on an interview and the interviewer says, hey, let's meet at Starbucks. And the interviewer, it's Saturday, and the interviewer shows up in a T-shirt and maybe a pair of shorts or sneakers. You are the one being observed. You cannot show up in a T-shirt and shorts. You have to be dressed appropriately, which would be business attire.
Excellent. I think that's a great point, because I think a lot of people, you know, not miss the boat on that one, but there's a lot of uncertainty. Because sometimes, too, I think when it comes to a potential job position, you know, maybe your job is going to be more relaxed or more whatever. And they're like, oh, I can show up in this tank top or something. And no, you should not. Like, even if eventually you're going to be in that.
You absolutely should not. I'll tell you this. I've been to so many job fairs, and I would say 80%, if not more, of the people, just visually, have zero chance of getting the jobs. Like, you know what? You might as well go home. Or you might as well not have shown up, because they are dressed so poorly or inappropriately, sometimes both. You know, inappropriate is something that's way too low cut for a woman. Inappropriate is having just your hair spiked up or what, you know, things that you could fix for the interview. You don't have to change who you are as a person, but you do have to change your presentation. You know, if you're having a formal dinner, you present dinner one way. If you're having a casual dinner, you may eat on paper plate. So it's critical to remember this is a formal experience, and you've got to make it a professional and a positive impact. And keep in mind, if you don't, and the next person shows up in a suit and you showed up casual because you felt like it, you've already lost. Even if you're the best candidate, you've already fallen down several notches, which could completely disqualify you.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is expert recruiter Stuart Taylor. Make sure to check him out, topperformers.com. What questions, Stuart, should you be asking as a potential employee when you're at the interview? Because I think a lot of people are scared of that as well, not wanting to be like too intrusive, I guess.
Well, you want to generally stay away from personal questions. You're there for business. Now, the interviewer may ask you certain slightly personal questions. It's illegal to ask a number of types of questions. So for the most part, interviewers are pretty good with that. As far as asking questions, there's two kind of types of questions. One is a basic fact-finding question. I define that as, what's the name of your company? What are the products you make? Where are you located? Who is your CEO? Basic fact-finding questions are, if I spent 5 minutes and went on the internet, I could get the answers to all of those questions. So if you go on an interview with basic fact-finding questions, you basically told the interviewer, I didn't do any research on you at all. I just showed up cold. You weren't important enough for me to spend 5 minutes to find out who your CEO was. You weren't that important. Now, a good question is, do your basic fact-finding questions, find out about the company, find out what you can about the position. You may talk to customers and find out, oh, here's some of the challenges in the marketplace. Here's some thoughts of mine on how I might handle those challenges. And then bring those questions that you formulate based on the information you've already gathered. Bring those questions to the interview and ask the interviewer, so I understand that you've got a new competitor in the market and, you know, they're very aggressive in XYZ area. How are you handling that? What's the strategy? So that's a question that just by virtue of the question, you have shown the interviewer, I did my homework, I did my research, and I'm interested. I'm not turned off by it. I'm just interested. I'm here to gather information. Those are the types of questions you should ask. You can also ask career-related questions and promotion-related questions. Promotion-related questions, like, you know, what are the steps? You know, where could I see myself growing? What type of advancement opportunities are there? Those are good questions because the nature of the question would suggest, if I'm interested in getting promoted, I know I've got to perform well in this job. So you're already getting someone saying, I want to grow, and I know I'm going to do well. So you're communicating that to the interviewer. Generally, any opinion-type questions are fine to ask. You know, what are your thoughts on XYZ? And if you have multiple interviews with different people, you can ask those same questions because it's different opinion. So those are some of the types of questions. And then probably the most important question is at the end of the interview, closing the interview and the questions that you should ask around that.
And what sort of lasting impression do you want to leave, Stuart, as the interview wraps up? Because again, depending on what you're going for, you might only have 15 minutes, it might be half an hour. But I'm assuming as much as you want to make a good first impression when you walk in the door, maybe you want to leave them with something so that you do stick out above the rest.
Yeah, you want to. Are you saying questions or just statements?
Our statement, like how would you, you know, want to see someone wrap up their portion of this interview as they're leaving the interviewer?
Jessica, it's very important at the end of an interview that you both make sure you can either summarize your own strengths of what you're bringing to the table, but critically important to make sure that you confirm with the interviewer that you've addressed all of their questions about you. Do you have any additional questions about me, my background, my ability to do this job, my fit with the company? That question opens up an opportunity for the interviewer to say, well, you know what, I don't have any more questions. You've answered all my questions, which tells you, okay, I've got the green light to move forward, and I'll get to that in a second. Or it gives the interviewer the opportunity to say, you know what, I do have a question about this. And it gives you a chance to respond satisfactorily to that interviewer's question so that you have now, you have a clean slate to move forward to the next step. And it's so important to explain this, that as an interviewer, when I interview people, I will never move someone forward if I have a question, if it's a significant enough question. That either needs to be answered by them then, or I may bring them back to ask the question again myself. But often, if I have a question that's not clarified, and I have a question with candidate A, but I don't have a question with candidate B, I will move forward with candidate B. So to make that lasting impression is, A, confirm that you've addressed all the interviewer's questions. Once you have done that, it is so important to enthusiastically, being yourself, but enthusiastically share with that interviewer that I am extremely interested in taking the next steps. You know, you can even confirm, based on my background, my ability, my skill set, the things I've shared with you, do you see me as a potential fit with this position? So you're getting buy-in from the interviewer. And then once you get the yes, and if you get a no, that means there's still a question, and you just stop and say, oh, okay, I'm sorry, what other questions do you have? But when you get the green light, it is very important to let them know that you are very interested in taking the next step forward. And that is something that sets you apart from your competition, because most people don't do that. They just say goodbye and they leave. And so that's I hope that answered that question.
Perfect. And Stuart, last thing before I let you bounce, just because I think this is a huge thing in this day and age with regards to social media. A, what do you say to, like, how should a potential employee answer a question if they are asked about their social media use, and can we look at your Facebook or Twitter accounts? Because I know that that's, I believe it's illegal, or they're not supposed to do it, but I know some people do it. And then B, you know, as apart from that, if you are, you know, just out of college or wherever, or needing to change your career, and you're starting this, interview process with maybe several companies, what should you as a person with regards to social media be doing? Like, I'm assuming you should make sure your account is, you know, not viewable, I suppose, to just anyone. And also, if you do have some scandalous beer bong picture, you might want to get rid of that.
You pretty much summed it up perfectly. I think that's an inappropriate question. The legality of it, I think, is on the fence, depending on how it's stated, etc. But as far as social media, you should either make it private, make things not visible, or shut it down entirely, depending on what you've got on there. You know, I've got a Facebook page that's very benign, so I wouldn't need to shut it down, because there's nothing on there that's out of line. But other people, and you're free to express however you want, may say whatever on their Facebook. And despite whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent, an employer is going to get an impression, formulate an opinion about you that could affect your employment based on that information. You don't want anything negative to affect your employment about your personal life. It's personal. So kind of going back to what I said initially, is it's best to either shut it down or make it not non-visible. The challenge is, if someone says, can I see your Facebook page, or could you invite me, or send a LinkedIn, is generally a little more professional overall. But, you know, people will ask to be friends. Well, what do you do? How do you tell an employer that you're hoping to work for? No, I'm not going to be your friend. Mm-hmm. So you put yourself, it's an awkward thing, and I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but my suggestion would be, like you said, take down anything that is could even potentially be viewed as inappropriate, or shut the whole thing down. Say, I don't have Facebook. I turn that off, you know, and you can turn it back on another time. But if you've got anything there, you're going to have to explain. You'll never even get to explain it, because they'll disqualify you before you even get to look at it.
Perfect. Stuart, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate all of your knowledge and advice.
Can I share a Twitter handle?
Yes, go right on ahead.
I just signed up for Twitter, and the handle is Get the job 123. Get the job 123. So if anyone would like to follow me on Twitter, that would be wonderful. And I think you gave out my website, which is topperformers.com. And we offer interview training, coaching, training for companies, training for individuals, sales training, resume writing, and all the works to help people get jobs. So thank you so much for having me on.
No problem, Stuart. Thank you very much. And again, that was expert recruiter Stuart Taylor. For more information on his book, How to Ace a Job Interview, make sure to check out his website, topperformers.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Social media has completely changed the way we get all our information over the last few years. Considering the fact that we become aware of everything from what's on television to what's happening in Syria through Facebook and Twitter, you'd think that this was a great way to share all information. But is this true about music? To talk about all this sort of stuff is our awesome social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
Good, good. So I guess the obvious question is, you know, what did music fans do before social media? And I kind of don't even remember in a way. And
I know, right? Well, that's the big thing. And it's crazy because you think about it, you think about how you used to, I mean, I know you're a massive Janet fan,
yes,
right? And what you used to do before was, I mean, you would kind of wait for information. I mean, you would wait even for stuff in the local paper, which sounds so ridiculous now, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
if you heard there was going to be an interview in the local paper or like in the New York Times, you'd go to a newsstand and pick up that paper. And, you know, you'd wait in line for tickets and you'd go to shows and you'd do everything you could possibly do. And I think it's really changed a lot over the last few years. I mean, it's changed obviously over the decades, but the last like 3 to 5 years have been the craziest.
And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I was just thinking back, you sort of, as soon as you said Janet, I was like, what did I do? And you're right. Like, I was subscribed to like Blackbeat magazine and like Write On magazine. And then, and like all the information I was getting, let's say in their news section or whatever, was like at least 2 months old by the time I read it, or like a month
Absolutely.
Old. And then anything, you know, to find out what was going on with her, it was always like, it was slow. It was magazines. It was, I spent a crap load on like, you know, Us magazine and People, like, just trying to find out what was going on, Rolling Stone, like all that kind of stuff. And you're right. Like, and then you'd wait. You're like, okay, is like a new single coming? What's going to be like all that kind of stuff. What about the average person though? Do they end up discovering, you know, more music now than before?
Yeah, well, it's true and it's not true at the same time. And I'll say that because you definitely discover more music than you ever could before. That's definitely true. But the problem is that there's so much of it. It's sort of turning into a thing where it's kind of ruining music. Do you know what I'm saying? Because there's so much information and so many new things. You know, people are always walking up to you saying, oh, did you hear this person? Did you hear that person? And it's almost as if we're not sort of devoting enough time to the stuff that we're discovering that we like. Because you find something and then you want to find something else like it for some reason.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? You saying that is, you know, I work in music radio and, you know, so I'm, you know, aware of what's going on, but I actually feel mostly unaware of what's going on. I feel like I cannot keep up.
Yeah. And in a way it's like, you can't, because, you know, there's so many things that we look at and listen to and pay a little bit of attention to, you know, like a lot of times you'll hear about something. I know what happens to me is that I'll read about somebody on a blog, let's say, and I'll say, well, this person sounds like they might have some really good music out. And then I'll find out that they actually don't have anything released.
Mm-hmm.
They only have something on YouTube or on SoundCloud. And so I'll go and listen to it. And then I'll say to myself, oh, I got to keep that in mind for when their album comes out in like 11 months. And then when the album comes out, I see the name and I'm kind of like, yeah, I know this from something. And then I listen to a track and it's not familiar because I only heard one thing a long time ago. And then you sort of forget about it again.
Right. And is there still a, I guess we'll call it a unifying authority, and is that a good or a bad thing?
Yeah, you know, I'll say there sort of isn't. I mean, the unifying authority now is the internet, but it's a little bit too sort of far-reaching if you think about it. Because, you know, back in the day, I used to read reviews in Cream magazine, in Spin, Rolling Stone, Interview. Those were the things that I looked at. I mean, people still look at the reviews in the Times and all that, but it sort of doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because you'll just see somebody write on Twitter that this person's new album sucks, and you've got that idea in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's amazing. Like, even I saw, here's an example. I saw the Drake album is out, I believe, this week or next week. I'm not sure. But he released the cover art early.
Okay.
He released the cover art first, and everybody immediately took to mocking it. And
really?
It turned into a meme, and I'm not even a Drake fan, but I saw about 15 different memes of his album cover. So in my head, it kind of gives me the impression that the album's bad.
Wow. Yeah, I could see that. I could see
that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I just saw, oh, people are making fun of Drake. I guess his new album's not very good. But because I'm not a fan, I'm not really close to it knowing exactly what's going on. You know, that's just an example. But it's just interesting because it's all over the place. You hear about everything and stuff gets on your nerves more because mm-hmm. you hear about it. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, you get a really weird perception always hearing about new stuff.
And how is social media affecting the industry and artists?
Well, it's just that, you know, I mean, it's the fact that, yeah, it's great you can get stuff out there and you can sometimes cut through with absolutely zero money, because you look at somebody like Lorde with that Royals song, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I mean, she literally came out of nowhere.
Yeah, New Zealand.
And she's really cut through.
Yeah. And she's
so
like,
it's a... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Well, she's on all the charts now, right? Like, she's making
exactly.
noise all over the place. But will she have a second single? That's the question now.
That is the question, because that song, I actually remember the first time I heard that song, which was only about 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and I actually stopped to go and look at what it was. I was just listening to, like, a stream of new stuff, mm-hmm. and I actually stopped to look at what it was, because it's very sort of arresting when you hear that her voice in the very beginning of the song. There's very little instrumentation, so that sort of thing. So she really cut through. But that's a good thing, but at the same time, you have so many people who are trying to do that. It doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to put your stuff out there, but I mean, it doesn't always happen like it happened for her. So it's kind of good for the industry and bad at the same time.
And I read something really quickly, actually a headline, and I haven't had a chance to check it out today, but apparently Justin Timberlake is streaming his new music already, which
of
I guess the album
is, yeah.
comes out, I don't know, I feel it's this week. Or is it, no, September 30th, I think is when it comes out. So he's already streaming it. So it's not really a hard release anymore. It's like, well, here's a bit. Here it is, all of it now, but you can buy it later.
Yeah, that's kind of the way people expect things now, though. It's crazy. It's like nobody wants to wait for anything. So the release dates don't mean a thing, because, I mean, they put up a release date, and then, you know, 2 weeks before the album comes out, they go, oh, but you can stream the whole thing on iTunes, which is good in a sense, because people can get to it quicker. And they say that that actually helped, like, the Daft Punk album, because that was streaming on iTunes.
Oh.
And they said that that gave people some familiarity, and it sort of made them commit to buying it once they've been playing it through their iTunes already. But at the same time, you got to go, isn't it just kind of, you know, you can get it anytime?
Yeah, well, that's
you know
because
I mean?
it used to be so exciting to be like, it's coming out on, you know, March 24th or whatever. Like, you know, you'd be looking forward to that. And even it's funny, like, again, if I go back to the Janet stuff for just a second, like, I belong to, I guess, a couple of Janet Facebook groups, if you want
right.
to call it that. And it's funny to see, like, how so many people, there's like a few really ardent Janet fans who will put up stuff like, oh, you know, today back in, 1993, the Janet album was released.
Right,
right. You know, so it's like, you know, and I remember that May 18th, 93. So, you know, so those dates meant something. And it's funny that 20 years later, people still, you know, I know obviously it's a niche market, but I'm assuming that people think that way about, let's say, Madonna or Aerosmith or whatever, like they might remember.
Oh yeah, people do it for everything. I mean, they're just celebrating the 20th anniversary release of the last Nirvana record.
Right.
In Utero. Yeah, you know, I mean, that used to be a big deal. I mean, the date used to be, you know, the street date, as we used to call it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, and it's like, it doesn't mean, like even this thing with Lady Gaga, like her album comes out November 11th, but I'm sure people, like apparently there's already snippets online anyways.
Yeah, for sure. Always happens. And you know, nobody really knows, the jury's still out on whether or not that helps or hurts the album. It works for Daft Punk. But again, the problem with judging creative stuff is that you can't compare Daft Punk's album to Justin Timberlake's album. I mean, regardless of what you're a fan of, you just can't compare them, because you don't know how people are going to react. You don't know if the fans are waiting for it. Everything's different.
Right. And is there a solution to all of this?
Well, the only solution is really, and I mean, people are starting to do it, which is an interesting thing. You do start to see a lot of sort of blogs and posts about specific albums that are really sort of diving deep into them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe that is going to be, it's going to be the trend. It's going to come full circle where people will go back to really sitting down and listening to things. I mean, you know, maybe there's going to be listening parties again, but, you know, online, right? Where everybody sits down and listens to the same thing at the same time. Maybe that's what the future is. But the idea is basically is you want to slow it down and try to really get into something. If I hear, like, I still listen to full albums. If I hear something from someone that I like, I will want to hear their entire album.
Right.
Because I'm assuming that there's going to be more stuff on there I'm going to like.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for myself, I make a point of listening to full albums like every day.
Oh, that's amazing. See, I don't think most people do that anymore. I think everyone is like this fast food variety. And, you know, like even myself, like, but it's funny because I think we had this discussion a couple weeks ago where I have whipped out CD copies and now put them in the car and listen from like A to Z.
Like that is old school.
That is old, especially because like I still get CDs from the record companies, which is, you know, it's very gracious of them to do that. And I appreciate it. So I feel like, you know, I shouldn't just skip to the song that I know or the second single that I think, you know, is going to drop or whatever. So I'm like, no, you need to listen to it in its entirety, especially like if they have worked hard to make transitions. Like I know some people don't transition between songs. Like it's just sort of cut. But like Janet, for example, she is an artist who will do transitions between songs. And it's sort of like it makes the album feel like one seamless thing, like entity.
Yeah, and a lot of times they are. You know, there's two schools of thought for that. Some people will say it's an iTunes world. You want to have the strongest possible singles out, 99 cents, boom, people buy your song.
Right.
And that's fair enough. Because I feel like that's one section of the market, but it's not the whole market.
Right.
The other part of the market is there are people like, you know, if you're a Springsteen fan, I mean, he writes a collection of songs. And he puts them out at the same time. I mean, it's very old school. That's just one example. But I'll give you an example with a new album, the Daft Punk record.
Yeah.
If you listen to that from beginning to end, it really is a great musical experience.
See, that's cool. That's cool.
And some people still go for that. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't, you know, they don't write their own songs and their albums are sort of a mishmash of the hot producers, right? Like
Rihanna.
You'll have a Britney Spears record and four songs will be from Will.i.am and four songs will be from, you know, whoever the hot producers are, right?
Yeah.
So there are albums like that as well. And you just want to hear the hot songs. But there definitely are still people who put out full albums and you might find a gem that you love that, you know, isn't necessarily a single or a video or anything, but it'll just be a track that you like.
That's cool. Patrick, thank you as always for this. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll see you next time.
That's our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Learn more about him on our website, kellyalexandershow.com, and follow him on Twitter at GetPatrick.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Have you ever felt uncomfortable or unhappy in a room or in a certain space? Could a lot of it have anything to do with the amount of clutter that is lying around? Let's face it, we all have our own piles of clutter, but just how much are those clutter piles affecting our lives? Lifestyle expert Christine Eisner joins us to talk about ways to begin decluttering your home to welcome in a new season. In our case right now, that means autumn. Christine, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
It is great to be back with you.
So let's talk about clutter. You and I have talked about this before, but we all seem to let it pile up. How often should we start to clean up our space?
You know, I think it's, for me, I hear the word clutter, and for me, clutter is about things. And what I think if you sort of look at it in a different way, what clutter really is, it's noise. It's noise in our lives that don't mean anything to us. It's stuff we can't, it does, it's unnecessary. So if you think about when you're in a noisy environment, you get out of that environment, you know, we're constantly monitoring ourselves to get out of noisy spaces. So I think to answer that question, how often, I think it really is an ongoing process. I think it's like eating or drinking or exercise. I think it's just part of what should become part of your lifestyle rhythm.
I wanted to ask you if clutter really affects our lives, because if I use myself as an example, I try to keep things fairly organized, but like we all know, things get, you know, out of control from time to time, especially if you're swamped at work or whatever. And I know that I'm coming out of a very busy time where it was just sort of, you know, I just sort of had enough time to keep the house clean, you know, sort of get the bathroom clean and the kitchen done and all that sort of stuff. So any sort of extra stuff got left to the side, I would say, off and on the last 2 months. And now, like, now this stuff, which is not out of control, but it's driving me nuts.
Yeah. And because you have all this unnecessary noise in your life, your spaces aren't clear. You can't operate in as smooth and effective a way as you can. I think it's huge. I think cluttered lives, whether it's too much stuff, whether it's too many things on your to-do list without having any sense of priority to it, whether it's too many people in your lives, whether it's too many emails in your inbox that haven't been read, whatever those are, it's a matter of really needing to take them out of your life. And the word I use is really not decluttering, it's streamlining. Because to me, streamlining is about getting rid of or turning down the volume, to use the noise analogy, turning down the volume on the elements in your life that are unnecessary noise, but then at the same time, turning up the volume on the things that are important to you, that are going to make your life more enjoyable, more effective, more just more what feels good to you.
What do you say to people who, again, we'll use myself as the example, in the last couple of months, like I was just so busy with work and just trying to get things happening on a day-to-day basis that sometimes, you know, something would come in. Or for example, one thing that's been going on is my mom, she is in the process of actually selling off my grandfather's house. He passed away a few years ago and we sort of held on to the house for a bit, but now like they're in the sort of final process of getting rid of it and selling it. And so I would say off and on the last couple of months, my mom sort of kept coming to me saying, hey, like, do you want this? Do you want that? Like, whatever. And a couple of things, you know, I sort of said no right away. But other things, I wasn't sure. So I said yes. So now I have like a couple of things that are sort of lying about, again, that are like, ugh, like I just didn't have time to deal with them. And now there's this whole guilt of like, do I get rid of it? Because it was grandpa's and stuff. So what do you say to people who might not make that immediate decision to either toss or deal with?
Yeah. And I, it's that sense of obligation and, oh my God, well, I can't get rid of this. We attach ourselves to this stuff emotionally. It's a very emotional kind of relationship that we have with the noise that's in our life, as well as the music, the good stuff. You know, I share with my clients and in my writing and in my book, the idea of having a gatekeeper. You're your own gatekeeper. But if you think of that little angel and devil on your shoulder, on each of your shoulders. Well, I think you need to add one more little character, and it's a gatekeeper, so that when you come into contact with something or someone or a new project, where you literally look at it and you have to intentionally, very consciously say, I'm going to raise the gate to let you into my life. And before you raise that gate, you need to think about, are you going to be helping me live the lifestyle of my choosing? Or are you, in fact, going to be taking me off on a side trip? And if it's the latter, then you need to say no. And if it's the former, then great, welcome it in. But at the same time, if you say yes to that thing, you know, the gate goes up, then you have to think, okay, how am I going to welcome this into my lifestyle, into my spaces, into my day-to-day routines in a way that it really is going to move my life forward? So say, for example, or give me an example of one of the things that you took from your grandfather that now you're it's sort of, what do I do with this thing?
Right. Well, I just looked at it today, actually, because I had sort of parked it on my kitchen table. It's one of those oil lamps, like with the wick and the whole thing. And I'm sure the thing is like 100 years old or something, you know, but I'm like, what am I going to do with this? And it was funny because I wasn't going to take it. And then I was sort of like, it wasn't really my mother that pressured me, but at the time my aunt and uncle were down and they're like, you know, you should really take this. This is like an antique. And I was like, okay.
And, you know, sometimes there are those guardian angels in our lives that say, that help us, you know, when our knee jerk is, I can't take one more thing in my life. You know, sometimes you still say, nope, I'm going to keep that gate down. But for some reason, you decided to raise the gate. And I think we need to really pay attention to those instincts. But then the idea is moving it from an idea to actually, okay, how is this going to make sense in my day-to-day life? So right now it's on your kitchen counter, your kitchen table, mm-hmm. and it's probably in the way and you can't light it or you whatever. It's fragile and the glass might break and all of this kind of thing. So I'll just throw out a couple of ideas. If I had two snapshots of some of your favorite places, I could probably just help you, I mean, even more. But I'm thinking that there might be a corner in a little table in your entry hall, or a shelf in your bedroom, or maybe the first place that came to my mind was like in your powder room or in your bathroom. You know, the corner, like if there's a shelf behind your toilet, or a little in the powder room, a little, you know, where you might have a votive candle for when guests come. Well, instead, if you actually clean the glass of the globe, clean it, you know, put in some oil, even think about going to Home Depot and getting the kind of oil that has the insect repellent in it. And then you can use it for, you know, you can actually use it, and it will actually be something that creates a glow of warmth in your entry if you're having some friends over for dinner, or, you know, you put it on a shelf in your dining room or in your kitchen so that you can take it and bring it out onto the kitchen table or onto the dining room table to create a campfire for when you have a meal, or if it's on a shelf like right outside, if you have a balcony or a patio or something, you know, then you use it and you bring it out and you're actually able to bring it and have it as part of your mealtime experience outdoors. So those are some ways to take something that is a passed on treasure from someone and actually make it something that is functionally relevant to your life. Do any of those resonate, or maybe they spur another idea?
Yeah, they have definitely resonated. There was a few in there that I think I could probably work out. And I'm grateful because like it's stuff like that that overwhelms me a little, because I'm like, oh my God, it's like an heirloom, and you better not screw this. You better not screw this up. So
right, and my point is, with each of the things that I said, you see, I'm putting them to use, and I would go, and what I'm all about is connecting the dots. Because we are too easily, we niche ourselves. It's like, okay, something's really pretty on a conceptual level. And then there's like a whole different box, a whole different category of stuff that is on our day-to-day. I think that it's really important to bridge the two. So to do that even more, the last add-on I have, and this is a really, really important add-on, is get a book of matches or a lighter or whatever it is. And maybe it's from a favorite restaurant. Maybe it's from a restaurant that you and he went to. Maybe it's a color that he liked or that you like, or maybe, you know, who knows. But and take that those matches and put it right beside it so that, you know, you actually use it.
Right, which is key because it is fully functional and ready to go. So
my first flea market find was one of those lamps. And so I know exactly what you're talking about. And really, they're so beautiful. They're so beautiful when they're lit. And the cool thing is every time you use it, every time you look at it, you don't have to use it. Every time you look at it, you're going to have this echo of your grandfather. And you're also going to have this echo of the conversation with your mother and your aunt and uncle, where they were saying, you know, this is a really special piece. So all of a sudden, and you'll also have an echo of this conversation.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, that one thing that was an object is now going to be a whole conversation that you will end up having with that what was a thing and now becomes an experience.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is lifestyle expert Christine Eisner. Make sure to check her out, comfortlivingbychristine.com. Christine, I wanted to ask you again, you know, where you and I live on the eastern side of North America, you know, we are sort of heading into fall season. That means different things for you and I, considering you're in a bit of a warmer climate. But I find like when we sort of head into fall and then, you know, winter's not that far off, it's sort of like this hibernating thing, obviously, that gets going on. And I feel like even people start that feeling sort of right away with the beginning of fall, like making soup and feeling like they're going to hunker down. My question to you about that is that more of a time where people keep clutter or collect things? Because it's like you're already sort of hunkered down, so you're just sort of like circling the wagons, if you will. And I'm wondering what you think about, you know, what you need to do in the fall to not maybe get jammed up when you have to do spring cleaning.
Right, yeah. And if you think about like animals, as winter approaches, they start hoarding, they start foraging, and they start storing their nuts and all of that. And we're very much cut out of that cloth. And part of that is, I think, our wanting to feel secure and safe in our spaces. You know, I think it's a very healthy thing to do. But I think it's a time where you can bring things in, and, you know, going back to the streamlining, you bring things in, but you also have to get rid of things. So in order to bring elements of the colder season in, which has all of its excitement to it and all of that, you need to let go of some of the stuff from summer. So I actually wrote an article about this and had, you know, visuals as well. But, you know, it's like, think about taking away, you know, elements of, it might be picture frames, it might be placemats, it might be even the towels. So, you know, as you think about you're heading into this season, so maybe there's a second set of, maybe there's a darker or set of sheets or towels that you might want, or placemats that you might want to incorporate. Maybe you put in where you had cream or white or fuchsia candles in your, you know, on your dining table. You know, maybe now it becomes, you know, ochre or moss green or red or whatever, other kinds of colors or dark brown. You know, so if you think about the energy that you bring, that summer and the warm weather brings to a space, think about now, you know, getting rid of some of that. And I don't mean necessarily throwing it away, but, you know, we have Christmas decorations. We take out our Christmas decorations for the season and we get all jazzed up and excited by that. And then at the end of Christmas, we put them away. So the seasons are very similar. So there might be certain things that certain decorative items or the pillows on your bed or whatever that you put away on flip covers. You know, the reason why I say God invented flip covers is to stay in sync with the seasons. So if you think about, as you're looking through your spaces, trying to declutter, and so I'm talking decoratively. You know, we can talk about the desk, you know, or whatever, the piles, but speaking decoratively, and sometimes when you look at what you know, appearances, and you start making changes, then you start getting more excited about the room that the desk is in, and you start making that feel a little better. And then your mind says, well, okay, now that I enjoy being in this room, and maybe I'm playing a different kind of music, you know, the beat music is off, and now maybe it's a different kind of music, now I can start looking at the desk, the piles, and I'll be motivated enough to say, okay, let's rein this in and try to create some order out of this. But I do think it's a matter of carving out the time, first creating the excitement, and then when you have that excitement, you know, take that energy and then channel it into like a couple of hours, you know, maybe two times over a weekend even. If you do a couple of hours two times over a weekend, when Monday comes around, you will be feeling so much better. And then going back to what we talked about in the beginning, it's not a one-shot deal. Then, you know, the next weekend or two afternoons later, you know, another hour, another 15 minutes, and then just keep in the routine so that you don't end up being strangled by your stuff.
What do you want to see from us as we, you know, march into fall, and then, because, you know, we're not that far off, obviously, you know, from holiday season, which again brings on its own sort of things, which, you know, you and I will talk about next time you're on. But how do you want to see us transition from autumn to being prepared for that holiday season when everything and their grandmother comes out? Because you usually have people coming over and you want grandma to see this, that you still have it and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, these are some of the routines I built into my life. And I am absolutely just as normal and human as every single other person, maybe even more so. And you can read between the lines on that. I mean, I'm a pile person, all of that. But what I do, you know, I use this time to polish silver, you know, silver frames, you know, do those when we have the time. If there's crystal, you know, wine glasses that might be put into use more, maybe I'll wash, you know, 8 of them. And then another week, another 8 of them. So it's not like, oh my God, you know, people are coming. I've got 20 people coming, and now I have to wash all the wine glasses. I have to, you know, the silver frames are tarnished or whatever it is. I try to do that as I'm going. The other thing that I'm doing right now personally is I have a list of people who I want to be buying gifts for. And as I'm looking around, you know, whether it's at farmers markets or just neat stores that are opening, because now it's this, you know, fall and a lot of new concepts are coming out, I'll just, you know, and if I want to support someone's business or whatever, I'll just start, you know, getting stuff now. And it's not like I need to get my Christmas shopping done early. It's actually something that I'm really enjoying doing. I get to buy something. I get to have it in mind who I want to give it to. And then I'm putting it in a place where it is my Christmas shopping. So I'm turning a chore into a pleasure. And I think that's really important for just overall wellness is, you know, we've got all these to-dos. You know, I sort of believe in a list of want-to-dos, or I'm going to do this right now because it feels good. Or I see this beautiful sarong and it's, you know, the end of the season sale at this wonderful store or, you know, whatever, a set of beachy placemats. And I buy them, but I'm thinking, I'm not just buying them and hoarding them. I'm buying them and saying, oh my God, this is so perfect for Kim because she's got a beach place that's here just about to, you know, be renting in February. And this would be a great present for Christmas. So by being organized in how I'm doing it and by putting it into a, you know, putting what I'm buying into a list, I'm ahead of the game in terms of stuff that I might be doing for entertaining because my silver's, you know, polished and my wine glasses are polished. And I don't mean right now, but over the next, you know, month or so, my Christmas list is getting less pressure. You know, my sheets, if I have some towels that are more seasonal, then I'll use those and maybe not use the white towels and sort of put the more bright colors down at the bottom. And then if we're talking in spring, then I'd be saying this is now the time to retire, you know, temporarily retire, you know, the wool throws and the cashmere throws or whatever it might be and bring out the lighter stuff. But in the same way that you have Christmas decorations or Easter decorations or Halloween decorations, you know, there's even the set of things of objects and routines that you might bring out in music that you might literally have in a box, and you just, and instead of saying Christmas or Easter, it says fall and spring.
Fantastic tips as usual. Thank you so much for this today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm always so happy to be on with you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That is our lifestyle expert, Christine Eisner, and you can learn more about her on her website, comfortlivingbychristine.com.
Bring on the remix.
That's Lady Gaga with Applause, the Liam Keegan bootleg remix on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, Stuart Taylor, Christine Eisner, and Patrick Charles. As per usual, I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Trisha Lee. You can love people and you can befriend them, but the only person you can ever 100% depend on is yourself. Don't forget to check us out on all of our social media, including our YouTube channel where we post all of our interviews, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. You can also follow us on Twitter at KAlexanderShow, on Facebook, The Kelly Alexander Show, and of course online, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.